My name is Einat Wilf, and this is the We Should All Be Zionists podcast. Each week, I'll be reading one essay from my latest collection of essays book, We Should All Be Zionists, on issues facing the Jewish people and Israelis today: conflict, peace, religion, politics, past, present, and future. At the end, I'll be joined by columnist Blake Flayton for a discussion on the themes of the essay and how they apply to contemporary Israel and Jewish life. You can purchase your own copy of We Should All Be Zionists anywhere you get your books. Thanks for listening. Let's start. Arguing Israel contra BDS. Transcript of a lecture given to the Academic Engagement Network on May 2017. I want to share with you my reflections on the larger issues of the BDS movement in Israel, and then move to some of the more specific conceptions of how I believe it is best to tell Israel's story, to analyze the conflict, and to argue our case. For quite some time now, I've asked myself, what is going on? And the question of what is going on has to do with the fact that as an Israeli who considers herself very much a liberal and comes from the Israeli left, I was trying to understand how it is that those who are supposedly my colleagues, those with whom I supposedly share values, seem to be turning more and more against an idea that I hold dear, which is Zionism. Why is this becoming so much more virulent? In that question also lies the possibility of beginning to ask whether I or anyone else is right in thinking of themselves as a Zionist. If so many people who supposedly think like us on other issues that we care about turn against us on this issue, then we might begin to wonder, so maybe we should turn against this issue as well. We are also used to thinking that Jews in general are aligned with liberalism, that a liberal order is the best protector of Jewish existence, both individually and collectively. So when those who are considered liberal turn against something that is very Jewish, such as Zionism, questions arise and we begin to wonder what is going on. This also has to do with a bigger kind of observation that I've made for some time. Is hatred of the Jews ever about Jews and what they do? When greater and greater segments of society turn against Jews, does this mean that Jews are doing something wrong? There are times we'd like to believe that this is the case, so we say that it is because of the occupation, or because we said this, or because we did that, because there is a very comforting underlying premise about it. It means that if we change what we do, we end the occupation, we do not enact these laws, then all of this will go away. But I think the answer to whether or not hatred of the Jews has ever been about the Jews is a simple no. If we look to history, if we look to the ebb and the fall of hatred of the Jews, the hatred has always been there, but sometimes it peaks and sometimes less so. When does it rise? It rises when there is a crisis in the society that is engaged in hating, not when something has changed with those that are being hated. When I began to see this rising tide of hatred, of virulence, especially the emotion and the violence that came with it, I did not turn my questions to the problem with Israel's policies. We can discuss that, but this is not the issue. Then what is the crisis that is taking place in the larger society and causing it to engage in this obsessive hatred? What is becoming clear is that there is a long-term crisis of liberal or left-wing thought, and maybe also in academia. And when there is a crisis of certainty, a crisis of identity, when societies don't know who they are, what they stand for, or why they exist, there is no greater comforting certainty than that the Jews are responsible. When people began to discuss the rise of intolerant liberalism recently, suddenly I said, bingo. Because we began to feel, even though at first we didn't understand what was going on, now it's becoming more evident and more people are discussing the larger trends. The battle that we are waging is not specifically on the issue of the legitimacy of Zionism in Israel. It is a far bigger battle. As much as we might all be interested in correcting the world and changing the situation, it is my belief that we should be interested first and foremost in making sure that as this battle rages on, we are safe. If there is anything that has changed for Jews in the last few decades since the establishment of the State of Israel, which prompted the growing comfort of Jews in the United States and around the world with the idea of Jewish power, it is that even though we recognize that growing hatred means that societies are in crisis, we are now less inclined to allow these societies to resolve their issues on our backs. And we plan either not to be around when they do that or to fight back and to make sure that as they resolve their issues, we do not get hurt in the process, first and foremost, physically, but also in all other ways. Intellectually, of course, but also in our ability to thrive, to have the jobs we want, to say the things we want, and to prosper. We will defend that as societies are in crisis and we see the corresponding rise in hatred against Jews in Israel. We need to acknowledge that this crisis is placing tremendous societal pressure, first and foremost on young people, on students on American campuses, and it is societal pressure to hand over more and more pounds of flesh, to more and more renounce their association with Zionism and with Israel, and with almost any notion of proud, powerful Jewish existence. But what these young people are going to discover one day, as all Jews always have, is that it does not matter how many pounds of flesh you give over or how powerfully you renounce your Zionism by saying, look, I'm the good Jew. I'm not like these other Zionists. I hate Israel. I'm fighting against it. Israel is awful. No matter how much you hand over, you will one day discover that it's not enough. What we need to be fighting for is to change the environment that creates that pressure. What we have heard about in this conference are the first battles and the victories that represent the initial repelling of the attack. Those are critical. We're getting better and better at saying, stop, no longer, you don't get to invade. But ultimately, that will not be enough. The oppositional tactics that were described are good, such as going to the academic associations and asking them, what does this have to do with anthropology or history or languages? But over time, what we need to do is change the story, change the narrative, because while those are specific tactics that are very good for winning specific battles, we need something greater. Here I will transition to what I think we need to discuss and to argue. We have two key elements. The first, the one that is on the attack or on the offensive, is the one that has to expose the other side, their motivations, their story. And the other element, which I don't want to call defense because it's much more than that, it's a different line of offense, is to tell Israel's story. First, on the issue of the attack, of exposing the motivations of those who seek to distinguish Israel's Zionism as a unique form of current evil, I want to offer a new idea. A new definition of what it means to be progressive in this context. I propose that being progressive means actually treating Arabs as equals. That means respecting what they say and taking them at their word. I know that there are neologisms now like mansplaining, so maybe I'll coin one called Westplaining, when the West seeks to explain what Muslims or Arabs are saying to explain it away. If someone, Arab or Muslim, will say, I want to kill Jews, their interlocutors will say that they are merely expressing pent-up rage for years of colonialism. But they're saying, I want to kill you, so let's start by taking them at their word. I want to offer the idea that being progressive, first and foremost, means looking at individual civilizations and cultures as equals by giving them the respect of actually taking them at their word and not westplaining away their motivations. What does that mean? It means that when we see across the Arab and Islamic world that fighting words against Zionism, placing blame on all-powerful Jews, or promoting the idea that the Jews do not have equal rights for self-determination are all acceptable in that society, we need to conclude that this is what those individuals or governments mean. And we must accept that it doesn't mean that doing so somehow paints them as evil or immoral. I genuinely believe that in this conflict, there are no good guys and bad guys, moral guys and immoral guys. There are just small guys and big guys. And I'll explain. Let's imagine for a moment what the conflict looks like from the perspective of the Arab world. The first part of it is that the Arab world is being asked to accept that the Jewish people have come home after 2,000 years. Now, who does that? Who comes home after 2,000 years, rings the doorbell, knocks at the door and says, honey, I'm home after 2,000 years. Can we genuinely agree that this would have been a conflict-making situation anywhere in the world? That's the first thing we're asking them to accept. Now, I certainly believe that Zionism is one of the world's most inspiring stories of a people who rose up to change their destiny of being victims, to change their future, to pick themselves up and do something different, truly inspiring. But I've also learned that in this life, there's a very fine line between inspiring and insane. Truly, this is an insane story. Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, could have told you that this is how Zionism in his time was received. One of my favorite refrains is from when he published his first book, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State. It was the talk of Vienna, which was a very Jewish city at the time, kind of like New York today. In all the cafes of Vienna, they talked about this crazy new book, and the common refrain was, for 2,000 years, the Jews waited to have their state, and it had to happen to me? So let's start by accepting that it was an insane idea and that we're asking the Arab and Muslim world to accept it. By the way, it's not just any people who are saying that they're coming home after 2,000 years, it's the Jews. And that matters. Because this is where we need the new kind of progressivism I'm talking about. Why does it matter that it's the Jews that have come back? We forget that now, in the 21st century, we live in an era when all ideas, ways of living, forms of faith, and lifestyles are equally respected. But if we are to understand what drives this conflict, and this is what I've learned to say to students, this is how I managed to get through to them, I tell them to please leave the 21st century for a moment and put yourself in the mindset of Game of Thrones as the seventh season is about to begin. What is the mantra of the Game of Thrones? When it's not winter is coming, it's you win or you die. It's brutal, but in such a landscape, you either win or you don't. Put yourself in that mindset that there is a new truth, that Christ is the Messiah or Muhammad is the final prophet. And with that truth, which you and your followers claim to be the final, the only truth, you are out there conquering the world. Now, how tolerant are you going to be of the tiny, pesky little people who say, nope, Christ is not the Messiah. He might be a lovely rabbi. He's not the Messiah. And Muhammad, he's not a prophet. Prophecy has gone from the earth for centuries. If you think that you win or you die, and that you have the final truth, how tolerant are you going to be of that kind of attitude? Obviously, not a lot. Thus, in both Christian and Islamic civilizations, as you know very well, Jews were accorded, at best, an inferior status. And the inferior status evolved over time to be part of the culture and theology of these civilizations, so that the Jews could only be tolerated as a miserable, marginalized minority. Their misery, in fact, became testimony to what happens to people who fight, who don't accept the final truth. This is, in my belief, a short primer for all of human history. I know it's very non-academic what I'm saying, but these problems began when those who you were used to thinking of as your inferiors suddenly come and have the gall or the chutzpah to say they are equal. How well does that go over? In contrast, today, we are somehow conditioned to believe that, yes, when people claim their equality, it's just come on in. I had a short political career, not a very long one, but it was long enough for me to learn one lesson, the only important lesson of politics, I think, It is in the very nature of power that no one, and that means no one, ever gives it up willingly. If you want power, you claim equality, or you want a different sharing of power structures, then you have to grab it, you have to fight for it, and you will face backlash. That is in the nature of power. And this is what Zionism did to the Arab and Islamic world. It challenged a power structure that existed for centuries, where Jews had a place, an inferior place. They were headed to the dustbin of history. Then suddenly, not only were they appearing with this crazy story that they were coming home after 2,000 years, they were also saying they were equal. They were a nation no less proud, no less important than the great Arab nation. And they were laying claim to land in the midst of the Arab and Muslim world. And they were taking these two things, the crazy story of coming home after 2,000 years, a people who were considered inferior, and the claim of equality, and they were doing all of that when they didn't have high population numbers. When Israel was born, the ratio of Arabs to Jews in the region was 50 to 1. Now it's 60 to 1. So all of Israel's investments in Aliyah, Jewish immigration to Israel, and fertility, and having lots of babies, has really not made much of a dent. We would probably have done much better to invest in female education in the Arab world. That would have improved the ratio much more than all our investments in Aliyah and making babies. There was never a way the Jews could reproduce themselves out of those proportions. They don't have the numbers, and they have this crazy story. In that context, of course the Arab world is going to say no to Israel. It is entirely rational. It's not about the Arabs being evil and Israel being good. It's about Israel being small and the Arab world being big. This is the context we need to bring back. The Palestinians are part of the Arab world. They are also part, broadly speaking, of Islamic civilization. Their engagement in the conflict is not that of some helpless victims who are just at the mercy of outside forces. Can we bring back the progressive idea that they are agents that are making conscious decisions with consequences, that they are informed by their understanding of history and power from the Arab and Palestinian telling of the conflict, that the Jewish power and the sovereign equal Jews in their midst are a temporary aberration? If so, then the occupation is not the cause of what we are witnessing, it is the outcome. Because at any given moment, the Arab Palestinians had a chance to have the dignity of liberty, of sovereignty, and a state of their own. But the price of that liberty, the price of that sovereignty would have been to say yes to the Jewish presence, to accept it as permanent and legitimate. At least to date, the choice has been not to say yes, and this is a conscious choice. If people can make a conscious choice to say, better to suffer the daily humiliations of a military occupation than to suffer the far greater humiliation of accepting that aberration, that presence is legitimate and final, that is a conscious choice of a people who are masters of their narrative, who in their mind are resisting and suffering for something that is honorable. Have you ever wondered why the emphasis in the Palestinian narrative is on the word justice? Never on the word peace, never on the word sovereignty, never on the word self-determination. It is justice that they seek because in their minds, the greatest injustice that has been committed is this undoing of an order where the Jews knew their place. That is the injustice. That is what needs to be corrected. So when many people hear justice for Palestine, what does it sound like? It sounds like we want justice for the downtrodden, right? Who doesn't want justice for the downtrodden? But no, justice for Palestine is a very clear Arab conception that literally means injustice for the Jewish people, and that needs to be exposed. I believe that it could be easily exposed by using the tools and language of equality and of equal rights that are supposedly tools only to be used by the other side. In my engagement with Arabs, with Palestinians, with progressive crowds, I always ask a simple question. Do you accept that the Jewish people as a people, as a nation, have the equal right, no more or no less, to sovereignty in their land? I have yet to find large numbers of people who will respond with a resounding yes. I have found one such person, a Palestinian who literally paid a very high price for his positions. But in Israel, if I argue for the idea that Arab Palestinians have an equal right to sovereignty and self-determination in part of the land, I don't need courage to hold these views. They are shared by many in Israel. Again, this is not because Israelis are good or moral people. I want to erase that from the record. We're a small country, so we take what we can get, and that's why we say yes. But from the Palestinian perspective, they don't see why they need to say yes. For someone actually and clearly to say yes, I accept that the Jewish people have come home, that they are not foreigners, that they are not colonialists, that they are not the Second Crusader states, which are all various synonyms for saying they are temporary, is a brave act. To say that the Jews have a right to this land just as we have a right to this land, and therefore we each need to have less than what we believe is our full right, takes fortitude. A Palestinian who says such things needs to have so much courage, he literally risks his life. Nevertheless, I believe this is the most effective way for us to argue. The idea of equal right for both collectives as indigenous people to the land. I am even willing to say, let's acknowledge the equal right of both peoples to claim all of the land, but then contend that if both sides insist that all of it is theirs, we will be at war forever. My Palestinian friend once said, I don't get it. I don't get it. What do you want? And I remember telling him, what do you mean? It's very simple. We want you to disappear, and you want us to disappear. Now, instead of discussing what we want, let's discuss what we can have. So this is what we need to ultimately acknowledge. Yes, there are big dreams here on both sides, but there has to be an acknowledgement of the equal right of both indigenous collectives to the land, and then an agreement about how to share and divide it. They want you to think of Martin Luther King Jr. or Mahatma Gandhi, and they want you to put their movement in that box. But there is no necessary connection between whether a cause is honorable and how it is waged. You can have an honorable cause for which a lot of blood is shed and that is fought for violently. Many honorable causes have used violence. And you can have a dishonorable cause that is fought for nonviolently. Indeed, the choice to engage in nonviolent battle is not because BDS supporters found religion and not because they converted en masse to pacifism. The movement made this choice merely because all violent ways have failed. Wars failed and terrorism failed and the Arab boycott failed. So now we have come to a kind of intellectual warfare. The fact that it is waged by nonviolent means should not blind anyone for a moment, because the end goal, the eradication of Israel, is very violent. How could a goal be violent but waged by nonviolent means? This means that words have consequences. When Israel and Zionism are repeatedly described as all that is evil in our world, I call this the placard strategy, because you see it in anti-Israel placards in those demonstrations. You've seen those placards, right? What do they say Israel, Zionism, and the Star of David equal? On the other side of the equation, it never says Zionism equals the political movement for the liberation of the Jewish people in their ancient homeland. You have yet to see such a placard. Even though the people at this conference are here to fight for Israel, Zionism, and the right of the Jews to support Israel, the placard strategy has been so effective that you all know the litany of charges that have been placed against Israel and Zionism: apartheid and racism and colonialism and imperialism and Nazism and genocide. And these words are chosen not because they reflect reality, but because they all share the fact that they are synonyms for evil. When you create a global intellectual mindset that says that there is a specific evil out there, this is an invitation to violence. Because what we know about human beings is that unless they are psychopaths, and that's happily the minority, human beings do not engage in violence unless they believe it's for the good. And there is no greater good on this earth than the eradication of evil. So in order to prepare the most extreme form of violence, you need to get people to believe that what they are about to accomplish is the most noble cause of all, the eradication of evil. And this is how a nonviolent struggle can have very violent goal. In this way, the story of Zionism has been hijacked, disfigured, trampled upon, and made into something that no serious Zionist would recognize. Now, I want to argue why this happened from the intersectional perspective. I want to argue that Zionism is and has been the most powerful intersectional message, which is this. Zionism is not just about the Jews and not only for the Jews. What then does Zionism really say? First, we must acknowledge that its message is influenced because it is a daughter of the Enlightenment, a daughter of modernity. If in a non-academic sense you want to divide all of the pre-modern era from the modern era, it boils down to this element. In pre-modernity, how you were born determined how you would die. And you could not challenge that because it was preordained. This was how society functioned. But what is modernity? Modernity means that we can challenge that premise, that how we are born is not how we necessarily die. We can change anything, including gender or our financial position, because our destinies are not preordained. This is a modern idea, and Zionism is a daughter of modernity. Zionism is about people, the Jews, acknowledging that they might have been dealt some of the worst cards in history, but that didn't have to be who they were. That didn't have to be the end of the story. Victimhood does not need to be the Jewish destiny, and Jews do not need to passively wait for God or the Messiah to fix things for them. This is why Zionism was a very secular, even militantly atheist movement at birth. What did it say to the Jewish people? It said, don't wait for the Messiah. Don't wait for God. You be your own Messiah. You be the vehicle of your own redemption. The story of Zionism is about people being the vehicles of their own redemption. It's a remarkably inspiring idea. It's about the fact that Jews could be oppressed, persecuted, marginalized, even much worse, and then could change that destiny. This is an intersectional story that Jews must share with all marginalized, oppressed people everywhere, that it can be done. But can it be done by relying on the American individualist model, which says stop whining, go and succeed in life because you're facing no barriers? No. Success is about acknowledging that the barriers, the biases, the problems, and then taking collective action. Zionism is about saying that it is collective action that changes history. If you want to break down those barriers, you will not do it alone. Instead, you can do it as a group. That is powerful and that is inspiring. So why is Zionism so defamed? Precisely because of that. If people get the idea that they can succeed in changing long-established power structures, what will happen in this world? People might get ideas, and that is dangerous. It is better for powerful people to make sure that Zionism is separated from blacks and feminists and gays because they don't need to see that it's possible, that they can challenge those power structures and change them. And Zionism even has a sequel to share, an intersectional sequel, because what we have to show is that even once we begin to change our destiny, it's not the end of the story. We are constantly facing backlash. Because when you challenge long-established power structures, you will have to defend your gains every day. You will never be able to take them for granted. The Herzlian idea that the Jews will have a state and this will cure the world of its anti-Semitism, well, that didn't work out so well. But that is part of the lesson, that yes, you can change your fate, you can change history, but you will need to defend your gains and you will face backlash, and that the backlash will have many forms, some of them trying to defame the ideology, the revolution, to the point that maybe no one will want to identify with it, and thereby it will be rolled back. That's the story that we need to bring back. And it's a story that allows us to create amazing coalitions and hopefully to break through to those who are saying that we cannot enter the room and in many ways, perhaps unbeknownst to them, are playing into that backlash. And I think those are the key elements. They might sound fanciful at this moment, but I believe that as we move from making small, effective, reactive victories, we need to move to change the story. Because our ability, and especially the ability of our young people to thrive, to feel confident, to know that they can live comfortably in an era of Jewish power and not be challenged, depends on the fact that they will understand that we have a different story to tell, and that they, even though they live in the 21st century, are subject still to very powerful forces who want the Jews to know what their place in the world should be.
So thank you, Einat, for reading that. I don't want to say essay. I want to say lecture, because it truly is a lecture. It reads and sounds like a lecture, arguing Israel contra BDS. And the first question that I had to kick off our discussion of it is in relation to a tweet that sort of blew up on the Jewish side of Twitter this week. And that is from Mohammed El-Kurd, who is a Palestinian. He's also I believe an aspiring writer and a poet, although I don't think this tweet is very poetic. He says, "You can't protest peacefully. You can't boycott. You can't hunger strike. You can't hijack planes. You can't block traffic. You can't throw Molotovs. You can't self-immolate. You can't heckle politicians. You can't march. You can't riot. You can't dissent. You just can't be." And this is in line with the anti-Zionist argument over the past several years that the Zionists won't let us do anything. And because the Zionists won't let us do anything, we can't protest in any way, shape, or form. We can't make our voices heard in dissent in any way. That is why they are handed things like October 7th. That is why they are handed things like random stabbing or shooting attacks in Tel Aviv. And if they just would let us boycott, divest, sanction, or call Israel all sorts of names on our campuses, or even present the Palestinian opinion in politically correct sounding terms, then there wouldn't be such violence and such mayhem. What do you say to that contention?
The answer, and this is an argument that I've heard for many years, is always the same. The problem is not with the means, but always with the goal. And notice how he weaves together violent means, hijacking planes, and nonviolent means. And that's actually telling, because he goes through over all the means, but never actually questions the goal. And the problem was not with the means, as abhorrent as some of them were and still are. The problem was always that the Arab-Palestinian goal and vision was that there should not be a Jewish state, that there should not be sovereign Jews anywhere, precisely because, as we discuss here, it challenges very deep-seated power structures about what the proper role of the Jews should be. Had the Palestinians, the Arabs of the land, had a constructive goal to establish a state next to the Jewish state, they would not have needed all these means, because they would have achieved that goal a really long time ago, really with doing very little. The reason that they have had to use all these means, both violent and nonviolent, boycotts and wars, is precisely because they have failed repeatedly to achieve their goal of no Jewish state. So they found themselves either escalating the violent means or trying to supplement them with supposedly nonviolent means like intellectual warfare, boycotts. But the problem was never with the means, however abhorrent. The problem was always with the goal, that it's a destructive goal rather than a constructive one.
Right. And speaking of intellectual warfare, and we had a form of this discussion when we were talking about the ICJ hearing, the charge of genocide that was leveled against Israel. And I asked you, why is Israel even a part of these conversations? Why did Israel even bother to show up? Why don't we have this sort of Benzia Netanyahu-esque thick skin where we don't even concern ourselves with the grumblings of the rabble, if you will? And that ties to BDS as well, and the entire point of this thesis, of this essay, in the sense that there's always going to be a public opinion warfare against the Jews, because societies are very hard to keep in line and are very hard to keep organized. And the second that there are cracks in their foundations, we serve the purpose of the ultimate scapegoat. The finger always points to us for reasons that we've talked extensively about. So then the question kind of rolls over. What's the point? If we have a state, if we did this, if we accomplished this mass shakeup of power structures and we clinched victory from the jaws of defeat and now we decide our fate and our future, we did the impossible, the miraculous. Herzl start us at all, that didn't start us on that track, but certainly helped us along the way. Then is that the end goal, that we have an army to defend ourselves and our soil and public opinion is going to do what public opinion is going to do? I think I'm more cynical in my answer because I've been in, not a long time, but for a while in these Jewish conversations of what do we do? How do we convince? How do we argue? And I've seen really nothing on that front get better, only in fact get worse.
So when I followed the hearings on the genocide libel, my first thought was that it's not a coincidence that Kafka was Jewish, because only a Jew could really come up with the world that then becomes that his name, Kafkaesque.
I think there was a piece actually where they related the investigations of a dog to the ICJ hearing, just about the absurdity of it, the Kafkaesque nature of it.
Exactly. And I sometimes compare this and even some of the debates that I participated in as the medieval debates, where if Jews won the debate and carried it, they were slaughtered. And if Jews lost the debate, they were slaughtered. So there was actually no way out. And I often think about it, and it's a constant dilemma. And I get invited to debates, and often I speak, and I'm like, should we bother? Should we bother being in the United Nations? Should we bother going to these hearings? Should we bother making our case? And I agree with you that there's no simple answer. There's definitely that sense of like, you know, let's just be Fortress Israel. Leave us alone. We don't care. We're not going to participate in these Kafkaesque charades. And then there's the other thing that says, well, at the end of the day, we're very small people. Whatever we achieved, we always achieved with allies, even when they were temporary allies, right? The Soviets helping us basically arm in order to be able to survive the Arab onslaught and achieve independence. The French who helped us in the 50s and 60s build our military power and then completely turned on us. So we cannot survive without allies. To have allies, especially as a small people, we cannot appeal only to interests. We need to also appeal to a greater sense of story, of narrative, even if it changes. But if it, you know, if it exists for a decade or two decades or five decades, at least then we can defend ourselves. We can accomplish something. So these are, and I agree with you, it's a real dilemma to which I don't have a quick answer of like, just do this or that. Yes, sometimes we have to go into those medieval debates in order to be able to make our case for those people who are our allies and at least need to know still why they are our allies against this constant onslaught. And sometimes we need to just say, you know, we're not participating in this Kafkaesque charade. And it's not even easy to always tell which is which and when is when, but it is almost the constant dilemma of the Jewish condition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And speaking of allyship, I came across another tweet. I really do hate how a lot of our content like stems out of what I saw on social media, because in theory, it should be this article I read, this book I read, this podcast I listened to. But sometimes no, because social media shows us what other people are doing and what other people are thinking. And it's very revealing of the discourse and how things are going. Yoni, do you think it's possible to play this video into the mic? It's a minute long.
As the days go by, I just get more and more angry. That doesn't even cut it. feelings that I have towards my own community, towards the Jewish community. God, it makes me feel... I was on the train yesterday on the way to JFK to get on the plane, and there was a group of Orthodox Jews in front of me, and my first thought was, I wonder if they are in support of this imperialist colonizer settler state that is Israel, and I wonder if they're in support of this occupation and this genocide. And then I immediately just, I want to just, like, stay the fuck away from me. Get away from me.
So obviously, that is an extraordinary video. And my caption to it on Twitter was, I could write a thesis about this, because that's not a joke. I really want to. The emotion, the crying, the anger. She says, you obviously, listeners can't see it, but when she says, get away from me, she makes this pushing motion with her hand. Like she wants to physically separate herself as much as possible from these poor Orthodox Jews that she saw on the way to JFK. So speaking of allyship, I have to admit that sometimes I get very cynical and I go into very dark places, that this emotion arising out of young Jews in the United States is almost unstoppable. It's unbeatable because it's very Jewish. If you look at our history, it's very Jewish to say, oh, those Jews are doing this. I want to physically remove myself from that and start this whole other definition of what it means to be Jewish. That's happened again and again, especially in modernity, or maybe only in modernity. Is it worth trying to bring those types of people back to be our allies by way of the points that you argue in this piece of flipping the narrative of saying, no, we are a minority in the region demanding equal rights, and they are the ones who refuse to be progressives, and they are the ones who you are not affording agency. Looking at someone who's that far gone, who's crying in their bedroom about, you know, having to be Jewish in the modern era, is it worth it trying to get them back?
So my experience has been that it's always a combination in which, on the one hand, we need to be clear on our story. We need to tell that constantly. And then we can always count on our enemies to not help themselves. So over the years, I've found, you know, people ask me, you know, what do we do, especially with young Jews who are, you know, using, and she, you could hear, she's saying settler, colonial. I mean, she's literally going through the placard strategy one by one, absorbed it completely, doing this performative. I spoke for years about exorcism ceremonies, and this is exactly what this one looks like. You have to show, to perform an exorcism ceremony in which you literally push, the way you talked about her movement, you push your Jewish identity out of you. You demonstrate to the world that you're the good kind of Jew. So we need to help create on our side the understanding of what's going on, and to know that there will be a moment when our enemies will not be able to help themselves, that someone like that will suddenly want to figure out what's going on. So when I say that our enemies cannot help themselves, and that also goes to the previous tweet, because their goal is not ending the occupation, self-determination for the Palestinians next to Jewish self-determination, because their goal is total, because their goal is for Jews to know their proper place, to go back to being powerless, defenseless, at their mercy, because the logic of that goal is their goal, they cannot ever stop. They cannot say, oh, Israel, you got out of Gaza. We're thrilled. We're now going to build Gaza into this beautiful pearl of the Mediterranean. They always continue onward because nothing less than the non-existence of the Jews as equals and sovereigns will satisfy that. And because this is the logic, ultimately, they take steps which lead more and more Jews to ask what's going on. And with that, I opened this talk. This is what happened to so many Jews on October 7th, that because of this brutality that was directed against the nicest, kindest, left-wing, progressive, most peace-seeking people. And it's not that the Palestinians attacking them didn't know that. They knew precisely who they were attacking. They knew precisely what were the political views of those whom they were attacking. Because the attacks were so brutal and against really the most peace-seeking people you could imagine, I think for a lot of people, something broke down that said, okay, this cannot be about some limited goal of ending the occupation or removing settlements. This seems to be total. This seems to be sinister, annihilationist. That goal has revealed itself in the brutality. And then a lot of Jews who, I can say, felt uneasy with my message for years, because my message was, this is what the Palestinians want, listen to them, give them the respect of accepting that this is what they want. And so many Jews engaged in this West planning of saying, no, 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 they want something else. And suddenly it was revealed in its full brutality, and they were like, oh, so it is what they want. And then they were scrambling, and suddenly all these speeches and talks and books that I've had for years now, as you know well, more people are listening now. So for me, for someone like that, I don't go and try to convince her. As I say, our enemies will do their part. I'm just preparing all the material that she can have once she's scrambling to find a different answer.
Once that realization comes, I do think sometimes, and obviously there's no part of me that wants this to happen or even thinks about this happening, because it's very dark. But I do think for someone who's that far gone, for American Jews, of whom I met a lot,
mm-hmm.
I do think it's only going to become evident when anti-Zionism becomes ever so popular in the United States that anti-Semitism explodes with it. When it affects them in their hometowns, in their home communities, and not just politically, but with violence. And obviously, nobody should look ahead to that future. But I do think that that is what it's going to take for these sorts of people to realize that I have been wrong and that this is a zero-sum game between Jews and the people who want us dead, regardless of what continent you are on. So thank you, Einat, for another interesting discussion.
Thank you.
Ma sheru mitorer, ma sheru.